On this episode of The Big Number, it turns out that what happens in Vegas does stay in Vegas, as we saw the NBA Cup team slump in recent games. Before we get to the show, a reminder to subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel to keep up with this show and all of our Yahoo NBA content. The Big Number, coming up right now. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome to The Big Number. I am Tom Haberstroh, and as always, we're joined by your man, my man, Dan Devine. Dan, what's going on, man?
Tom, I am enjoying myself in this. As we get into the dog days of the season, I feel like that's when I really lock in. You know, like, I've been giving you, let's be honest, perfunctory effort for a while now, but this, when everybody else starts getting weakened, you know, beaten down, this is when I really start to shine. So I'm ready to go, man. Let me hear it. Let me hear what this week's big number is.
This week's big number, Dan, is 433. That is the collective win percentage of the three NBA Cup champs in their next 10 games after they won the NBA Cup. Collectively, 433. Dan, it's not great. That is the equivalent of a 35-win team over 82 games. And I did the math and researched this. It actually is really interesting when you break this down that, you know, between the Knicks and the Magic and San Antonio and OKC, they join a group that after this NBA Cup, they've struggled. You know, San Antonio has been okay, but OKC has bottomed out. The Knicks have forgotten how to play defense. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. And Orlando is really soul searching right now. And after this next 10 games over the last 3 years, the collective win-loss record for these teams, 13-17. And in all other games, listen to this, in all other games, NBA Cup teams that go to Vegas, so the final, you know, four teams that go to Vegas, in all other games, they go 105-65 for a win percentage of 618, basically a 50-win team. So what we're saying here is going to Vegas and participating and competing for the NBA Cup results in the last 3 years, a 50-win team basically turning into a 35-win team. So is this an NBA Cup hangover, a Vegas hangover, Dan? We have proof here. We finally found proof that what happens in Vegas is staying in Vegas. Dan, what do you make of this?
I mean, I think everybody needs to be drinking some more water, maybe wake up in the middle of the night, throw in some ibuprofen, you know, get yourself in a position to where you can hit the ground running in the morning as opposed to stumbling through the next 3 weeks. The sample size concerns, et cetera, right? We're talking about 3 years and 10 game segments here. It does seem like we have seen teams that go to the end of the line in Vegas. So not just travel, you know, making it to the quarterfinals and traveling to Las Vegas, but going through semifinals, going through the finals, and then having to kind of go right back into the primary schedule, you know, the main NBA season schedule right after that. It seems like it takes them a little bit of time to kind of find their footing, or that they, you know, some of the air aspects of the game that might have been kind of snare drum tight right before get a little bit looser on the way out of that tournament. And the argument from the league's perspective would be like, well, listen, everybody's playing the same 82, and there is a value proposition here in terms of there is something to compete for and to win. It is a net good. It is additive to the experience of individual players who can stand to make a whole bunch of money in that situation to a, you know, team and league where we're driving interest in a portion of the calendar that previously had been a little bit, you know, the dog days, as we were just talking about. From a team perspective, you got to say, well, all right, yes, there is that tournament that we can win. One team's going to win that. On the back end of it, if we are in a dog fight in those dog days for playoff positioning, for seeding, for win, you know, tiebreakers against division or conference opponents, et cetera. And we come out flat in the last couple weeks after that because the schedule kind of gets bunched up on us and we've had a little bit extra high leverage games. Like, is that worth it to kind of push the pedal to the metal? And yeah, maybe again, maybe it's a short-term blip, but it certainly seems like all of the teams that have gone the distance here. And then we saw in years past with the Lakers and the Bucks, you know, coming out of their tournament victories, like maybe this is something to keep an eye on.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you, as someone who stays up very late for these Blazers broadcasts, this schedule for the Blazers when they didn't make the cup was very nice. It was very nice.
Sure.
It was, all right, so it was, I had a game December 7th, and then 3 days off, a game December 11th, 2 days off, and then another 3 days off in that NBA Cup time, which, dude, you know, that's an eternity in the NBA schedule to have
yes.
multiple days off in between games for like three games. It was incredible. And so it's not so much, and I've done stories on this before, the home court advantage is also a way to think about it, is flip it on its head and think about the road disadvantage. So it right. may not be that it's that the hangover is felt by the championship teams. It might be that the teams that didn't go to Vegas are feeling refreshed and rested and ready to take on the Knicks and the Thunder and the Spurs and the Magic. And it might be a case that that schedule condensing for fear with, I do fear that I'm going to get like a lightning bolt from the NBA league office about talking about sure. schedule density with the NBA Cup. Shouts to John Hollinger. But this does feel like to me something that the Knicks already talked about, right, Dan? If I remember correctly, the Knicks were talking about how this is kind of tough. We go to Vegas for a couple of days. We have a day off on the 17th, and then we got to go play at Indiana. Okay. Like not the toughest landing spot after the NBA Cup Vegas trip. But they've been awful. And I wonder, you know, part of this to me is thinking about the plexiglass principle that was coined by Bill James, of course, the godfather of baseball sabermetrics. Bill James wrote in his baseball abstracts that a lot of the rookie of the year sophomore slump is really a cognitive bias, or at least something that we would think would happen based on you outperformed expectations, and the sophomore slump, quote unquote, after a rookie of the year winner is nothing more than a regression to the mean. That the Madden curse, right? The Madden curse seems like a real thing when you consider, oh, they're on the cover of Madden because they had such a great year above expectations. They had an overachieving season that you're going to put that guy on the cover of Madden. And inevitably, they're not going to be able to maintain that because they were already overachieving above the norm to begin with. So anything falling down to the mean is going to seem like a slump. In the same way that the Knicks winning the NBA Cup, if they didn't win the NBA Cup, would we be talking about this if they went on a 5-5 stretch after the break? Maybe not. So is there the other one, the Sports Illustrated, remember the Sports Illustrated curse where it was like, if you made the cover of Sports Illustrated, it would be like a curse. And I think this is all kind of in the same stew, right? Is I think that there might be something to the travel effect and the how hard they play in the NBA Cup. I do think they treat it like a playoff game. The NBA treats it like a playoff game and the players do too. There's extra money on the line. And I do think that there's probably a little bit of, wait, we got to go around. We got to turn around and play some games after all these other teams are resting for 2-3 days straight. And I should caveat here that the Spurs are not really feeling the after effects of this. They went to the finals and they've been pretty good out of the break, even with Victor Wembanyama missing a couple games. But I will point out here, the data is really interesting. It's enough for me to want to track this going forward. I do think that the NBA Cup hangover is real enough that I'm going to be looking at this and tracking this going forward, because the semifinalists, the teams that go there, the four semifinalists have a collective win percentage of 608 in their following 10 games. That's a 50 win pace, which is equivalent to basically what they are outside of the NBA Cup. Right. The finalists, they go from a 50 win team in their next 10 games to a 45 win team. And then the champs go from a 45 win team in the next 10 games to a 35 win team, essentially. So the direction of that hangover, or the direction of that kind of drop in performance after the NBA Cup, makes me feel like there might be something here. And I kind of just, you know, as Dan, you tweeted, a small price to pay for immortality is the NBA Cup hangover. So you joke about this, but in your heart of hearts, if you got a truth serum to Jalen Brunson and the rest of the team and OG and Karl-Anthony Towns, do you think they would rather not win the NBA Cup. I still think they would rather win the NBA Cup than not, and not get those bonus checks, or at least the maximizing those bonus checks. But I do think that there might be something to this.
Yeah, I think, well, first off, I feel like if you gave Jalen Brunson truth serum, the answers would still be the exact same, like, you know, coach speak monotone. Like, it's been so drilled into him for so long. He and the other Knicks, you know, it's no excuses culture, right? And yeah, you know, we just got to figure it out. We're not playing our best ball. It's this bad. We got to work on it, et cetera, et cetera. I do think, to your point, there's something to be said about the fact that, like, all four of those teams, where we're recording this on Wednesday, so the teams that are playing on Wednesday, it'll be their 12th game in 21 days, all four of these teams. And the, like, 18 teams in the league have played fewer games than those semifinalists in that span since the December 18th, including a handful of teams that have played fewer than 10, including teams like the Celtics, who've been red hot, the Clippers, who've been red hot, the Lakers, who just won another clutch game last night, the Grizzlies, who've been sort of trending upward, Bucks with this got Giannis back, the Sixers getting all sorts of national love for their turnaround recently. Like, they've had a bigger spread between games. And so you wonder if that does play a role in some of their uptick and some of the swooning that we're seeing here. And, like, yes, you mentioned that, you know, the Spurs have been, they've broadly been playing well. They were also the only one of those four semifinalists that got a 2-day break, or that have gotten a 2-day break yet in the schedule. The other ones have been playing all every other day or back to backs. And with Orlando, Wednesday will be their 12th game in 21 days, 9 of those 12 on the road. So the schedule did them no favors. And so, as you mentioned, you know, the Knicks come out of that final, and then I think it was a Thursday, Friday, it's a road game in Indiana. And yes, the Pacers are really struggling this year, but the Knicks sat like half their rotation in that game because they were the quick turnaround off the cup final, and then had to fly back to MSG for the Sixers on the following night. And then from there, it's just been every other day or a back-to-back for like 21 straight days with no more than 2 games at home. So I think that, like, I'm sure that, you know, the league's data will tell you that this all evens out over the course of the season, and there'll be pockets where, you know, yeah, your strength of schedule here is weaker, your strength of schedule here is heavier. You know, you get some rest disadvantage games in this chunk, you get some rest advantage games there, it all comes out in the wash. And maybe that will wind up being the case, as you sort of noted, like, there's the trough of the immediate post-cup performance there, but these teams do tend to, you know, bounce back to their level of 605 or whatever that winning percentage was. Perhaps you will see that over the course of time. It doesn't mean, though, that we can't, you know, put under the microscope the reasons why these teams have been struggling of late. Some of it might be schedule, some of it might be fatigue. There also are, though, some, like, on-court actual issues worth noting for these teams, because all these teams that made it to the semifinals or the finals of the NBA Cup also have their sights set on being deep postseason teams competing for an NBA championship. And so the stuff that has contributed to these downturns, probably still worth taking a look at as we try to figure out sort of where they look in the long term.
Yeah. And we'll do that. And I think we're at the point where this expansion talk that we're seeing with the NBA, I do think that there's a lot there, because I think the goal is to have a 32 team tournament in the NBA Cup. You know, like, there's 30 teams in the NBA right now. You add 2 teams and you could theoretically have a 32 team NBA Cup that I would hope that they would cut games from the schedule to make sure that the winner of the NBA Cup doesn't have to fall and say, like, look, we have a really tough schedule going forward. I wish we didn't have to win the NBA Cup. We don't want the hangover talk to happen. So if there is a way to build in, to kind of give a little bit of a cushion in the NBA schedule so that the champs aren't penalized having a disadvantage coming out of the NBA Cup. And I know the league office might say, like, there's the Don Draper Mad Men line of, that's what the money's for. Like, you go and you win the NBA Cup, we gave you an extra mil. Sorry, this is the price you pay for winning the NBA Cup. I hope you enjoy that check that you got. So I hear that too. I just hope that there's just too many games in the schedule in general. And I feel like the NBA Cup championship hangover could be solved by just building in a couple extra days for the champs to, you know, kind of reorient themselves before they get back into the regular season grind. So we'll talk about each of these three teams that are struggling right now that went to Vegas, Orlando, the Knicks, and OKC. We'll start with OKC with three little numbers from you, Dan, coming up right after the break. All right, Dan, this week's big number, by the way, 433, the collective win percentage of the NBA Cup champs in their next 10 games after winning in Vegas. A 50-win team basically turns into a 35-win team so far in the last 3 years. What to make of it? We're going to jump into the Oklahoma City Thunder that, according to David Purdom of ESPN, a team that favored against the Charlotte Hornets, I think it was 15.5-point favorites. They lost by 27. At OKC, the Thunder suffered the largest gap, the most biggest upset in like at least 35 years, according to ESPN's Dan Purdom. That was the other day, and it kind of brings us to the Thunder. Like, what is going on with the Oklahoma City Thunder that were 24-1 before losing to the Spurs in the NBA Cup and have been sputtering? So what is your first little number about the Oklahoma City Thunder?
First little number this week is 538. No, not the website. 0.538 is Jalen Williams' true shooting percentage this season for the Thunder. That would be the lowest of his four-year NBA career. It's also down near the bottom of the league among high-volume players. Among 52 dudes who've played at least 500 minutes this season and have a usage rate of 25% or higher, so like star-level usage, that ranks 47th. That's the 47th best true shooting percentage, or alternately, the 6th worst in that sample, ahead of only Brandon Miller, Jordan Poole, Jeremiah Fears, Russell Westbrook, and Ja Morant, which for a guy who just made All-Star, All-NBA, is not where you're looking to be. As you might remember, Jalen Williams missed the first 19 games of the season, rehabilitating from offseason surgery to repair a torn ligament in his wrist. The Thunder went 18-1 with him out of the lineup. Since his return, they have gone 12-6, including 6-6 in their last 12, starting with that cup loss to the Thunder, or to the Spurs, rather. Their offense has dropped off to 16th in the NBA during that stretch, that 12-game stretch. So from up near the top five down to the middle of the pack. And Jalen Williams is shooting 49% on twos and 32% on threes, just under 3 3-point attempts a game in that stretch. So the efficiency is down. The volume of threes is down as he continues to sort of figure out his new normal with his wrist. Not the only reason they're struggling. A lot of guys have been struggling with their shots since they came out. But Jalen Williams as the number two guy, you're like no doubt about it, all NBA caliber second option. If he's not able to play himself back up to that level, the theory of the case kind of changes for OKC, no?
Yeah, it for sure. It reminds me of like the Jason Tatum conversation with the Celtics. Is like they've been playing so well without Jason Tatum. Just wait until they get Jason Tatum and how much better they will be. And I'm like, well, it's going to take some integration, especially someone coming off an injury. And for Jalen Williams, J-Dub has not looked like where he was last year. And the shot hasn't been falling. The assist turnover, like all the other stuff has more or less been there. So maybe this is a case of him just without a training camp, without a ramp up. This is just him having his own training camp in preseason, in the middle of the season. But it gets at something, Dan, that is really interesting to me is when they got their full squad back, like full squad starting five, everyone, including me, was like, just wait. You thought this team was going to win 70 games? What about 75? What about they might run the table the rest of the year because they haven't even had their starting five? I probably said this like 10 times right before J-Dub came back and Isaiah Hartenstein was coming back in the lineup. And since they've played together, the starting lineup, full squad, 1-4. Dan, wow. 1-4. They've lost four straight to open up. They lost to San Antonio by 2, Minnesota by 5, San Antonio again by 20, San Antonio again by 15. And they did beat the Philadelphia 76ers 129-104. So they're 1-4 with their new full squad starting lineup that won them a championship last year with Isaiah Hartenstein, Lou Dort, Chet Holmgren, J-Dub, and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. No Cason Wallace in the starting lineup. No Aaron Wiggins in the starting lineup. No, none. Isaiah Joe, whoever they were putting into the starting lineup. They pull those guys out of the starting lineup with their full squad lineup, and it hasn't been great. And it starts with Jalen Williams, who, you know, is a tier below where he was as a as an all NBA talent, all defensive talent last season. And I wonder, do you think that this is just 3-point variance, that, you know, his shot isn't falling and the rest of the team's shot isn't falling? Because Oklahoma City's opponents are shooting lights out, much better than they did before. The Thunder's opposing 3-point field goal percentage during this stretch since the NBA Cup, shooting 38%, which is 28th in the NBA in terms of 3-point defense for the Thunder. Their own 3-point shooting, the 33% offensively. So that gap was flipped, obviously, when they were 24-1 and going gangbusters on everybody. And the 3-point shooting percentage defense has always been kind of less control over that than you think. And now it seems like that variable, the 3-point shot, they can't shoot at all. And it starts with J-Dub, who's just not been efficient.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. And it's a similar tale for a lot of other teams too. You know, we'll talk about how the Knicks defense has been falling apart. Teams are shooting 40% against them from three in this stretch. So some of that is, you know, that'll cool off. You'll get that regression and maybe things look a little bit rosier when they do. But the Thunder have still been a top, I think they're fourth in defensive efficiency since the Cup. So it's like, even with the 3-point variance on the defensive side of it, that they've still been elite on that end. It's where the offense has fallen off. And so some of it is, yes, it's just these guys, you know, like Alex Caruso's shooting 22% from three since the Cup. You've got Cason Wallace, Lou Dort, Aaron Wiggins, and Isaiah Joe all under 40% from the field, not just from three, overall since the Cup. So like, these are guys who have made shots at a higher level, and you'd expect them to be able to do that further on. Also, you mentioned Isaiah Hartenstein. He's been back out of the lineup. Their offensive rebounding game just basically evaporates when he's not there. So like, that's another pathway to points that and additional possessions or extended plays that's just kind of gone in this stretch. So that is a factor here. But I think it's not just that Jalen Williams isn't knocking down the threes. And of course, like, 6 weeks back from, he had surgery to repair his wrist. Like, he played the entire postseason with a ruptured ligament in his wrist, where he had to basically he made a YouTube video about it this summer where he kind of described the process. Like, he had to reteach himself how to shoot, like, in the playoffs last year. So he went through the whole postseason with that, dropped the 40 ball in the finals with a busted wrist, by the way. And then was down over the summer, was out for all of training camp, missed the first 19 games of the season. And so he's sort of relearning how to trust that, and also just develop the rhythm and feel in real time. So yeah, I think a little bit more than 6 weeks of grace, it makes sense to give it. Unfortunately, the NBA schedule doesn't afford you that. Like, you know, if you're not up to snuff now, you can be in some dire straits.
Yeah, and we will give them that grace. And of course, mainstream talk about the Thunder, we certainly will be analyzing why a team that was about to win 75 games in the regular season and threatening to win the all-time record is now playing just like a 500 basketball team. And then that Charlotte game was a huge wake-up call. One thing I want to note about this, Dan, something I'm keeping an eye on, is that starting lineup I talked about earlier. They've only played 41 minutes, and they've done well in those 41 minutes together in five games. If you do the math, that's 8 minutes a game that Mark Daigneault has trusted them, or at least not trusted them. It's a very low number for a starting lineup, and I wonder what that's about. That they go to other play, you know, is it a function of they love their bench so much that they're just wanting to get Cason out there and getting their other guys out there? Because in the playoffs, that starting lineup, they averaged about 20 minutes a game when they played together. So I feel like there's something that the team, whether it's a reflection of the bench units and AJ Mitchell and Isaiah Joe and the rest of the guys, that they want to get them out on the floor. But it's very clear that they're breaking up that starting lineup, even when it does play the full squad starting lineup, they're breaking it up early. And I don't know if there's like a guy left early in injuries. Hartenstein's minutes were normal in these games. So I don't know what to make of that, but it is something to note that Daigneault is not trusting that starting five nearly as much as they did in the playoffs and last season. So something to keep an eye on.
Number two in our little numbers this week, 28. That is where the Knicks rank in points allowed per possession. after the NBA Cup, according to Cleaning the Glass, 28th as in the third worst defense in the NBA, ahead of only a Nuggets team that, as we've talked about on this show, is basically gone like its entire starting five for most of that stretch, mm-hmm. or at least part of it, and the Jazz, who've just been like the worst defense in the NBA for 3 years running. So that's not the neighborhood you want to be in. Let's populate that neighborhood a little bit. Since the Cup final, the Knicks rank 20th or worst in opponent field goal percentage, opponent three-point percentage, opponent free throw attempt rate, opponent turnover rate, opponent points off turnovers per game, opponent fast break points per game, how often you let your opponents shoot at the rim, half-court scoring defense, and points opponents add per possession by attacking in transition. Okay, so that's basically like every way you can be bad at defense. The Knicks have been bad at defense over the last 11 games. And yes, Josh Hart has been out since Christmas with a sprained ankle, and he's a huge part of their team. Landry Shamet, who's been one of their best point of attack defenders off the bench, he's been out since before the NBA Cup, since Thanksgiving. So eventually, you know, the attrition of you're down a couple of rotation guys that are helpful can really damage you. But man, it shouldn't be this bad on defense, should it?
Oh, no. And the quotes coming out of New York, I feel like they're hinting at something, that there's some internal locker room discussions that they want to keep internal, which we know that the New York sports media will be like vultures on that roadkill. It's like, oh, we're going to get to the bottom of this. Karl Anthony Towns is saying they have to go back to the drawing board. You wrote a great piece for Yahoo Sports about this. Is just the idea of this Knicks team that is normally billed as like a great defensive team with great wing defense, they've been a disaster defensively since the NBA Cup. And that is Tom Thibodeau's brand of basketball. So if they're not able to play defense at a top 10 rate, people in New York are going to be very upset, you know, that the whole brand of this team was that a lunch pail, grind it out, defend at all costs. And yeah, anything, if we can get great offense, amazing. And Jalen Brunson, if you build a team around Jalen Brunson and Karl Anthony Towns, of course, you're going to have to balance both offense and defense. And it's not going to be top five every night. But this, it's untenable. The Knicks have to be better defensively. And the way that they're talking about this suggests that there is some sort of chemistry issue or something internally in that locker room that they're not all on the same page. Dan, if you could put if you could keep your third eye open on this or have some sort of like, what do you think is going on here? Why, Dan, do you think they've been so terrible defensively? Is it one thing or is it just they're springing leaks everywhere and it's just a matter of getting through this stretch?
I think it's a couple of things. I think first off, the reputation of those Tom Thibodeau Knicks of like their defense first, grinded out lunch pail. It's worth noting that for the last 3 years before this year, the Knicks were better on offense than they were on defense. The last three years finished second, seventh, and fifth in offensive efficiency, finished 19th, 10th, and 12th in defensive efficiency. So the offense has led the dance for the Knicks for the last several years. So that's one thing. The other thing is, so much of it starts at the point of attack, right? It's a very basic principle. If you can't keep the ball in front of you, if you can't stall dribble penetration, you got a driver coming into the lane, you're having guys have to suck in off the wings, you know, help early, you're collapsing the coverage, and then there's open opportunities for, you know, spray out passes, kick out, catch and shoot threes, or a guy to catch, beat a closeout, get into the rim, or get into the paint, and then take an up close shot. And so the Knicks have been, which is out. You know, it's the way everybody wants to play or many teams want to play. Certainly the way that Mike Brown wants to play, the amount of times you hear him say spray out three, like it's one of his favorite phrases when he talks about basketball. And that was the way that the Knicks were playing. And we talked about it on this show where like Jalen Brunson's dribbles were down, Jalen Brunson's time in possession was down, all those things. That was like what was really fueling the Knicks' offensive success going through the NBA Cup final. So the thing that I'm wondering about with this is, yes, you're seeing leaks sprung all over the place. I think there's potential solves for that. Like, do you try Deuce McBride in the starting lineup? He's maybe your best point of attack defender. It makes you smaller overall if you're removing somebody else for him. You know, if Josh Hart goes to the bench when he comes back, or you know, if you're going instead of the double big look with Mitchell Robinson and Karl Anthony Towns, it's Cat at the five, and then you're moving in Deuce instead of, you know, like Mo Diawara or some of the other players that have wound up in that sort of spelling Josh Hart. But, you know, another point of attack defender could be useful. And then the plus minus numbers have always been really good when Deuce plays with Jalen Brunson. Part of me, though, wonders if from a chemistry perspective, in this stretch where the defense has been terrible, the offense has also taken a step back. And in that time, Jalen Brunson's usage is up, the dribbles per game are back up, the time of possession is back up, the seconds per touch are back up. And so you have moments like where they get absolutely, their door is absolutely blown off by the Pistons on Monday night. And it looks like Jalen Brunson's the only guy who showed up because he scored 25 points. And meanwhile, Karl Towns makes like one basket. And OG Anunoby, I think, had 6 points or something like that. The question that I have is like, if everybody saw the way it worked, you know, when we were spraying, you know, more egalitarian, spraying the ball out, sharing the wealth, and things were going really well, when we hit adversity, if Jalen Brunson's response to it is, I got to do everything, does that sort of leech out the vibes for everybody else too? Like, and it's all kind of hard to blame Jalen Brunson sometimes if he looks at it and says, I don't know that I can trust Karl Towns to not pick up 3 offensive fouls right now and like, you know, do so, or for nobody else to be able to dribble against the kind of ball pressure that a team like the Pistons can throw at you on the perimeter. So, but then the flip side of that is if none of those guys are touching the ball, if none of them are getting shot attempts, Jalen Brunson had 6 turnovers without an assist against the Pistons. Like if you're not able to generate those things for other people and everything is just Jalen Brunson, 40% usage going up against the world, it diminishes the talent around him. So chemistry on the defensive end is one thing. Yes, communication is huge. Do you have the point of attack defenders to be able to stall dribble penetration up top? But also, if you're having bad offensive possessions and then you're having to get back on defense, and especially if one guy's maybe also not getting back on defense and complaining he didn't get a call, and then you're giving up a bucket, then you're taking the ball out and having to go against a set defense again. And you're, you know, these things can be vicious cycles and they can accrue. And so that feels a little bit like where the Knicks are right now. Of course, you know, it's only as good as, you know, it only lasts as long as tomorrow's, you know, opening pitcher, right? You're tomorrow's starting pitcher. That's how far momentum goes. I wonder if, so all it might take is one great offensive performance against the Clippers to tilt this, but it certainly looks like a team where like the offense being stagnant is leaching into the defense and then vice versa. And then before you know it, it's a bad deal and it's everybody's fault.
Yeah. The old cliche in basketball is a cliche because it's true. Oftentimes is that the best offense is where, man, I butchered that. Great. The best offense is a great defense, right? Because you're anytime you're turning the opposing team over, and anytime you're getting those fast breaks, getting transition opportunities, that is the mother's milk of a great offense. And so I do think that when you're the Knicks and you're always pulling the ball out of the basket, it's going to slow your offense down. And all of those warts about over dribbling and Jalen Brunson just going 1-on-5, all that stuff rises to the surface when you're not able to get stops. When you're getting in transition and Josh Hart is out there and wreaking havoc defensively, it is the straw that stirs the drink. So I do think that, Dan, this is this could all be fixed once Josh Hart comes back and plays a few games here and we're able to, you know, put this in the rearview mirror. But that's not the only team in the East that is struggling post Vegas. What's the other one that we got to talk about?
Yeah, third and final little number this week is 16.0. That's the on-court, off-court swing for Jalen Suggs of the Orlando Magic. And what that means when I say on-court, off-court swing. When Suggs has been on the floor this season, the Magic have outscored opponents by 11 points per 100 possessions, which is very good. When he has been off the court this season, they have been outscored by 5 points per 100 possessions, which is bad. And you add that 11 and that 5 together, and you've got the on-court, off-court swing of 16 points per 100, which is the largest on the Magic by a significant amount. But it's also the third largest in the entire NBA among players who've logged at least 500 minutes this season. There's Giannis, there's Nikola Jokic, and then there's Jalen Suggs.
Jalen Suggs, no way.
I swear. Giannis is over 20. Jokic, I believe, is around 18. And then 16 points per 100 possession swing for Jalen Suggs. It's, and as we talk about why teams are struggling in this post cup sort of haze, Suggs has missed 9 of Orlando's 11 games in that stretch, which again, they're also without Franz Wagner. So now you're down 2 starters, but Suggs, again, that kind of bellwether for them. One of the 2 games that he did play, he left early. He hurt himself against the, or he was hurt on a foul against the Chicago Bulls the other night, near the end of the third quarter. When he left the game, they were up. They got their doors blown off in the fourth quarter. They lose that game to the Bulls last Friday. And without him on Tuesday, the Magic got hammered by the Wizards badly enough that Jamal Mosley pulled his starters before the end of the third quarter. Paolo Banchero, Desmond Bane, Anthony Black, none of those guys got back in the game in the entire fourth quarter. It was all reserves that got them almost got them out of a 26-point deficit, but they fell short again. So now they're 6-8 without Jalen Suggs on the season, 14-9 when they have him. Like, it's not just him. There's the Wagner component. There's also Mo Wagner they haven't had all season. Like, there are guys, there's valuable pieces that have not been able to be part of it. Banchero has been hurt. They haven't had their main dudes all together all at once all season. But it seems like when you look at the specific things that Suggs gives you on the defensive end at the point of attack, the way he can create, end a possession and get you going the other way, the way he's a complimentary passer, playmaker, someone who can organize your offense, not a great shooter, but a willing one, and somebody who's willing to attack the basket as well. Like, all of the things that he, like the gaps he plugs, it really feels like Orlando misses those a lot when he's not available.
I hear you, and I wonder what is the more surprising stat, that he is third in the NBA, and you know what, it is the Jalen Suggs one, but that the fact that the Magic with Paolo Banchero on the floor, the swing is -6. So you got on one end is Jalen Suggs at a +16, but the Paolo Banchero, who's the face of your franchise, the number one overall pick, the all-star on the team, he hasn't been enough with this team in the absence of Franz Wagner and Jalen Suggs. It has to be enough. He's Paolo Banchero, and they got Desmond Bane on the team and other guys, Anthony Black making the leap, but they still haven't been able to beat, which is a pretty cupcake schedule since the break. Since the NBA Cup, in the last five games against Toronto, Indiana, Chicago, Indiana again, and Washington, with Banchero on the floor, the Magic are -31 with him on the bench, including this last one with the Wizards, where Jace Richardson and the rest of the team like put on this charge, and when they got pulled, it's -31 with Paolo Banchero on the floor and +25 when he hits the bench. And that has to flip. Like, they have to figure out a way to get Paolo Banchero back to his winning ways and back to being a winning basketball player, because the stats say he's a star, an all-star. But the on-court, off-court stuff is a huge problem for the Orlando Magic. When I wrote about this a couple weeks ago for TomTheFinder.com, a lot of Magic fans were really upset with me that I was belittling, kind of crystallizing the Paolo Banchero experience into just one little number in his plus-minus. But I could tell you, no team wants their star player that they're about to kick in a max extension next season to be continually with a minus when he's on the floor. Jalen Suggs can't be the reason why this team goes from a East championship contender to basically a 30-win team. It can't just be Jalen Suggs. You have too much talent on this team, and as much as I think Jalen Suggs has been awesome this year, I think it is indicative of why is it Jalen Suggs is basically Nikola Jokic for this team. Like, what is it about the Magic that he is just everything to them on both ends of the floor? So important.
Yeah, I think that some of it is, it's the all-in-one stats or the advanced metrics. Very often they're picking up that you're additive, even if it's not necessarily scoring, right? It can be that he's his assist to turnover ratio is pretty solid. He's more of a combo guard than a pure point, but he is a good solid passer, somebody who is able to set up other guys and then also look for his own shot. He is a willing catch and shoot option, somebody that you have to honor out. So like, when you've got those Paolo drives or those Franz Wagner drives or Desmond Bane getting downhill, he's somebody else that can make something happen when you spray the ball out to him. The defensive stuff, where it's like, it's deflections and it's steals and it's the amount of loose balls he was able to recover. It's like all of those things add up to your defense is just markedly better when a guy like Suggs is on the floor. He's also big enough to be able to handle the tougher perimeter assignment across either your point or your two guard. So like, it makes your the overall job of winning your minutes as a lineup a little bit easier having a guy like that. He doesn't have to be super high usage or super high scoring to be super high value. And I think when those guys are out of the lineup or when they're not right, like, it's so much of watching Jalen Suggs makes me think so much of watching Marcus Smart in Boston for so many years, where it's like that he's never going to be the best guy on the team, but he might be the most important guy on the floor, for good or for ill sometimes, every night he's out there. Because he injects that energy, he injects the pace. The Magic always seem to be moving at kind of half speed in those half court sets. Paolo as good as he can be at getting to his shot and creating his own thing. Like, there's just not a lot of snap in their half court sets, the way they attack. And Suggs, if nothing else, is an energizer. He's somebody that adds a little bit of amplitude and energy to them on both ends of the floor. And without that, like, you still have good players. You've got, you know, Anthony Black as somebody who's rising up in the NBA and making a name for himself now. Like, you can put him in the starting lineup and he's a perfectly good high quality player. It's just a little bit different, right? And so, like, if you are you know, trying to figure out what sort of makes a lifeblood player, what makes a kind of talismanic player for a team, a lot of times it's those sort of indefinable things that are hard for us to discuss on a more statistics-based show. But with Jalen Suggs, it shows up in, like, the estimated plus-minus, in the on-off, in the, you know, his box plus-minus, in some of these other things where he's like a top 40 or 50 player in the NBA by these advanced metrics, even if it's 15 points and 4.7 assists a game. And you're like, well, that's nothing special. When he's not there, you notice it. And I think that's, like, everybody else is, like, a little bit turned down when he's not there to turn him up. And with it, the problem being, of course, with Jalen Suggs throughout his career, there's been a lot of times he's not out there, partially because this intensity that he plays with, he winds up picking up a lot of knocks, spending a lot of time on the injured list where he is right now. And for this Magic team that has sights set on being at the top of the East as opposed to fighting its way through the play-in, they need to either get him back pronto or figure out a way to energize themselves without him, because it's evident when he's not out there.
We're going to turn up for Trae Young Wizards talk here in a bit.
Woo!
Yeah, we're excited. Trae Young on the trade block for the Atlanta Hawks. According to reports, he is being openly shopped for a new destination here ahead of the trade deadline, which is in less than a month. Sorry, I didn't mean to scare you, Dan. Deadline. Just a lot of panic. Trae Young, we're going to talk about the latest reports and the Wizards potentially being the destination for Trae Young. Ice Trae going to D.C. Right up after the break. Before we do that, though, I want to remind everybody about the YouTube page, the new YouTube channel, Yahoo NBA. Go check it out, where you can get the KOC show, the Kevin O'Connor show, the Dunker Spot, this show right here. Go subscribe to the new channel, Yahoo NBA YouTube channel. It's got all our stuff. So go subscribe. Also, wherever you listen to this podcast, go rate us 5 stars, please. Leave us a positive comment. And actually, on this, next week, we'll give you a shout out. The best comment in our YouTube video, we'll give you a shout out next week here on The Big Number. So go check us out at Yahoo NBA on YouTube, our new channel available now. All right, Trae Young. We got to talk more about Trae Young. Dan, we did it last week. We kind of mapped out some potential trade destinations. We didn't talk so much about the Washington Wizards. I even threw out the idea that maybe the market for Ice Trae has gotten so cold, Dan, that it might be a Bradley Beal situation, Damian Lillard situation, that they just might say, look, we don't want to take on the long-term salary stuff. We don't want to give out picks. If you're going to take on Trae Young's contract, which has a player option for next season at $49 million, that we'll just buy him out, waive him, and then stretch it over the next few years. Doesn't seem like that's a realistic possibility right now, because is that the Washington Wizards music? Yeah, it is. Here we go from Steinline, Mark Stein breaking the news over the weekend. And then we have another report from our guy, Jake Fisher, on Wednesday morning, saying that the Hawks and Wizards have indeed engaged in serious discussions on a Young swap, league sources tell Steinline, but a trade might not necessarily happen fast. What he here is hearing that they kind of want to open this up and continue seeing if people are interested in Trae Young and his $49 million player option next season. And Mark Stein here, that this is centered around CJ McCollum's expiring contract. Now, if you are, Dan, the Washington Wizards, I can understand why you'd be interested in Trae Young being an offensive facilitator, leading the league in assists pretty much every year, a guy who has typically, we think of having a great three-point shot, but it's more league average. But defensively, just really, really tough defensively, which is one of the reasons why he's so hard to build your team around, is because it requires a particular set of skills on the defensive end to play with Trae Young. So I don't love this, and I wrote this for the Yahoo Roundtable that went up. If you haven't checked it out, go look at that for the NBA Roundtable that we did this week on the Trae Young Wizards kind of partnership. I don't love it. I don't even like it, but I guess I'm okay with it. Dan, what do you make of this Wizards acquiring Trae Young for CJ McCollum's expiring contract? Is this something that gets you up in the morning and replaces your coffee?
Yeah, I mean, it's got me jacked and pumped like I'm KOC over here. Like, I mean, who can argue against the idea of Trae Young Wizards talk? I love that you're like, we didn't mention the Wizards last week. I mean, how often does anybody mention the Wizards? So it's very nice. And which, by the way, we should note the Wizards. Yes, we talked about them just blowing the doors off the Orlando Magic. 7-5 in their last 12 games. Keep an eye on the pesky Wizards of Washington. So the ballpark.
Do they even need Trae Young to win a championship this year, Dan? Is really what we're all wondering. What we're here for.
To win a championship, that's right. As they shake off the NBA Cup malaise and move into their rightful spot as Eastern contenders. Also, speaking of which, our guy Ben Rohrbach wrote a piece for Yahoo Sports that went up just before we started recording this post, or this podcast rather, about that idea of like, what should the Wizards make this move? If so, why so? So worth checking that out on yahoosports.com. The framework is probably something like, because CJ McCollum has the expiring contract. He's around, I think, like 33 or so, or 30.6, something like that. The framework is probably something like CJ plus Corey Kispert. That gets you up around like $44-45 million in expiring salary, which can match up pretty well with Trae. And there, you know, might be some smaller pieces kind of added in. But if you are the Wizards, the argument for it is we've drafted a whole bunch of guys in the last few years. We've got Alex Saar, we've got Keyshawn George, we've got, Bub Carrington and Will Riley, and they just drafted Trae Johnson. So they've got like wings. Bilal Coulibaly is still there. There's like a big and there's wings and there's not really a point guard, right? There's not really a playmaker. I mean, to the point where earlier in the season, it's been like, could Keyshawn George be like is he like Arcade or something like that, right? Like, I think he's averaging like 6.5 assists per game because he's been handling the ball a ton. And, the Wizards have been bad offensively because when you play all these young guys, especially young guards, that's what happens. And so the idea being, this would provide like an organizing principle, someone who could get those guys shots, somebody who you would have to honor on the perimeter, even though, as you mentioned, more of like a league average shooter, but certainly somebody that still draws defensive attention. Somebody who could, like, there's nobody on the Wizards that's really going to get two to the ball and force a defense into rotation. And Trae Young can be that. So like, I get it from that perspective. And when you sort of map it out in your head and you're like, well, Alex Saar's a role man, right? Or he can be a pop threat, but like, give him a role man to the rim. You got Trae Johnson's a shooter. Bub Carrington's been knocking down his jumpers. Justin Champagne is getting more minutes there recently. Like, he's a guy that can stretch the floor. You know, if you give Trae shooters and a role man, chances are you're going to have a pretty good offense. The questions are on the other end of the floor. But then, like we've talked about last week, what do you want to surround Trae with? Like, what do you need to even make the argument? Well, Alex Saar has been awesome as a rim protector this season. He's improved by leaps and bounds. Leading the league in blocks. I have the number here. Hang on one second. He is holding opponents to 51.6% shooting at the rim when he's the closest defender, according to Second Spectrum, which is sixth best in the league among guys who have contested at least 100 up close shots. So like, he is ascendant in that area where like, you have a backline rim protector, which the Hawks haven't really had for a lot of the time that Trae's been there, and they haven't had much this season either. So, and then length on the wing. Coulibaly's, a heck of a perimeter defender when he's, been able to be in the lineup. George is big. You've got positional size with guys like Bub Carrington and Trae Johnson and Riley and whatever, the guys they've drafted. There's like you could see it. You can squint and see the outline of a team that kind of makes sense. But then we said that about Atlanta. And, you know, the Hawks didn't really work out super hot with Trey this year. But so like for the Wizards, it feels almost like a free roll, right? Like you are in a situation where if all you're giving up to get Trey Young is CJ McCollum's expiring contract and Corey Kispert, who is perfectly fine, but not necessarily, they're not exactly changing the fortunes of the Washington Wizards franchise. And you're in a position where maybe you have the cap space to be able to pick up that player option next year without it really hurting you and still add to the roster. You have Trae Young at 27 years old, so there's still some runway there to figure things out. Like plus the argument of like maybe even you're getting picks in the situation. That was something that Stein had reported. Like they're maybe looking for the Hawks to kick in some draft capital for taking on Trey's contract. So like it feels almost like a what do you have to lose move. Although I'm guessing you have a little bit more of a jaundiced view of that potential addition.
Do you know how much money they have on the books? I'll just tell you for next season. They have $67 million on the books for next year.
That's not very much in the salary cap sport.
Yeah. Salary cap's probably going to be like, what, 160, 155, somewhere in there. So as Jake Fisher wrote about for Steinlein, is this could be Trey Young's player option is actually a value add for them because they got to reach the salary floor. And so they got $60 million coming off the books, 64 really, with Chris Middleton and CJ McCollum coming off the books. And so they got to make rules, or they got to like be within the league rules of reaching enough salary there. Corey Kispert's their number one contract, most expensive contract next season at $13.9 million. So in a way, they're doing like the albatross of $39 million for Trae Young next year for other teams might be prohibited, but for the Wizards, like that's, again, like you said, a free roll that actually might be a value add for them. So this is, Keith Smith from SpotTrack, he says he projects Washington have over $80 million in cap space this July with 12 roster spots accounted for. That's $80 million for three roster spots. And that's where Trae Young comes in, is that player option. Maybe he waives the player option, does not exercise it, and agrees to some sort of extension for, you know, 3-4 year extension at like 25 a year or something like that. The Wizards are a destination in that sense. And Alex Starr has improved defensively as a rim protector. And the other two that I would say, if I wanted Trae Young, I would make sure I have one of these two guys on my team is Victor Wembanyama and Rudy Gobert, French guys, French bigs who can defend and swipe away at the paint. That's right. And Alex Starr, there you go. So Trae Young doesn't make sense in Minnesota because of the fact that his salary is so large. Who is Minnesota going to put into the deal to make the contracts work? It's not Rudy Gobert, because you need Rudy Gobert if you're going to acquire Trae Young, and you need Jaden McDaniels if you're going to have Trae Young. If you're going to hide the opposing point guard from Trae Young, you need a Jaden McDaniels on the team. So I don't see any other teams really stepping up, and that's part of the reason why this trade has been, even though the Wizards have popped out as a strong contender, the Atlanta Hawks are trying to get other teams involved here to see what they want to offer for Trae Young. But I'm with the Wizards here. Is I'm like, who else is going to pony up the money, or at least the money that you need to get to Trae Young's number, other than us with CJ McCollum's contract? And I don't see a lot of other suitors here. So it's like, you know, when people were arguing against the NBA Cup, I'm like, well, what's the alternative? Like November, December games in the NBA schedule, as if like that's something worth clutching our pearls over. The same thing goes for the Wizards here. Like, I don't love it for the Wizards, but also the alternative is like they have CJ McCollum and Chris Middleton as salary flotsam on their roster. And like, okay, if Trae Young is the answer there for the next few years, I feel okay about that, as long as they don't give him a max extension or something crazy where it's like, yes, you do acquire Trae Young's player option next year, but don't turn that into an albatross contract and just try to convince. It would be the very Wizards thing to do, is to just race to the middle, you know, and just be perpetually in, you know, a play-in team territory with Trae Young. I don't think that's the idea.
I would agree with you on that. And I think the idea of the Wizards have taken several years to kind of like dig out of the financial hell that they were in after the John Wall contract, after the Bradley Beal contract, and like put themselves back in position to where there's all sorts of flexibility moving forward. Now, like the idea of then instantly saying like, here's a 4-year max for Trae Young, that would be, it would seem like it would run counter to the roster management and the long-term vision that the Wizards front office has put into place over the last few years, where they talked about like the deconstruction phase before you could even begin to think about what you're building. The flip side of that is, I think we talk about Trae Young, you know, when we were like, well, where does he even make sense? You know, our guy Morten Jensen wrote a good piece for us at Yahoo Sports this week about like kind of the tricky nature of building around stars with warts like Trae, or to some degree like Paolo Banchero, as you were just talking about. And so, can that player be, you know, a one or a 1A or even a two on a championship team? And those questions are all perfectly valid. The Wizards went 18-64 last season, 15-67 the year before that. They have not won more than 35 games since 2018. They have never won 50 games in a season. They haven't made it past the first round of the playoffs since 2017. Like, there's a large gap between what Trae Young can provide for you as like a championship caliber team and whether you can just like have a good player that helps you be better than that. And if Trae Young, if the version of Trae Young you're getting is one who is making the absolute top dollar and sees himself justifiably as the face of your franchise and sort of the prime mover around whom everything is constructed, that can be a tricky situation. If you're getting Trae Young and saying, we can pay you for next year, if you want to have a longer term deal, we're going to have a conversation about at what price point and for how long. And your job here is to elevate and like provide some stability and an organizing principle for all of these young guys we've been drafting, including potentially another like mid to high lottery pick this year. That's a different ballgame, I think. And like, can that make us interesting and relevant in a way that would be palatable to our fans who have, you know, we've kind of haven't given much reason to be excited for quite a number of years. So I think like just because somebody isn't a perfect player for the NBA finals doesn't mean they don't have value in terms of what they can produce in the league. And I think that's kind of the tricky middle ground that Trae Young's in. And so for a team like the Wizards, even if there are all those sort of tricky aspects of working around Trae Young, like the things he can provide to help spur the further development of a young guy like Alex Sarr, who could really use reps with a great pick and roll ball handler, or you know, wings like Trae Johnson or like Bub Carrington, who Keyshawn George, who could really use somebody to set them up for easier shots, because like there's nobody that really is making life easier offensively for any of those guys right now. There's value to that, especially as all these guys continue to grow. Whether it winds up being the right kind of deal, the right kind of value proposition for either side. If you're the Wizards and you get picks or a pick in that, that's kind of incredible. If that winds up being the way this works and you turned like, you know, Bradley Beal three steps later into Trae Young plus picks, like that would be, you know, like the paperclip exercise. Like that's that would be unbelievable over the course of an asset management string. But yeah, I don't know. I see upside for it in Washington. I don't think that they're like, they've been pretty good recently. I don't think we're too worried about them upsetting the apple cart. Yeah, Trae Young is a damaging defender. They've also been really terrible at defense for a long time. Like if you're already bad at that, if you can get organized on the other end, maybe there's some value in it.
Call it in, Washington Wizards with Trae Young winning
let's
the
do
NBA
it.
Cup next year. Come on, let's. I doubled down there.
Oh,
you know what?
Sorry. I got ahead of myself. I was like, yeah, let's do the deal. You went right to Vegas next year. That's incredible.
I mean, NBA Cup, all NBA Cup team member Trae Young, of course. Right. You know, put it on the board.
Shaking
We're
the
talking
dice,
about the
shaking
hangover
the dice on the
for
floor
the
at MSG. Oh,
yeah.
I love that. Listen, not for nothing, if we get to a point where the Wizards were like a 600 team before the NBA Cup, they make the Final Four and they're struggling on the backside of it, it would be the like one of the most titanic year-over-year leaps we've seen in NBA history. So I think, you know, there's something to be striven for. Who knows? Not a professional writer. So whatever that would be, something to reach for the Wizards. And, you know, maybe Trae Young helps you get up that ladder.
Dan, this was a great episode, and I'm very much looking forward to how we reverse cursed the New York Knicks and the Oklahoma City Thunder next week. So that's what we just did. We did it. We exercised the demons. Apparently there's like, I mean, I know we got to end here, but apparently there's an asteroid, Phaeton or something like that, that the Thunder haven't done well since that asteroid. Our planet ran through it. It's on Reddit.
It's on Reddit.
Throw
so
it out there.
That's good.
Something to.
I had a friend that would whenever you would sort of say like, oh, this thing's been going wrong recently. It's like, oh yeah, well, Mercury's in retrograde, and I have like a real like. I don't understand astrology at all. And to the point where I was just like intimidated by the confidence with which she said that. So I was like, oh yeah, totally. This is because Mercury is in retrograde. So yeah, whether it's Mercury is in retrograde, there's a Phaeton, what was it? Asteroid?
Yeah, I don't know.
That we're passing through.
I don't know.
No, it's okay.
I saw a headline and this is what I'm regurgitating. Yeah.
That's all right. You know, we're creatures of the internet, so we see headlines and we regurgitate without reading it. Read all the things at Yahoo Sports, though, especially like listen. I'm constantly writing, so just keep showing up there and reading it, everybody.
Yeah, go read Dan Devine over at Yahoo Sports, his latest on the Knicks. If you want more Dan Devine than what we just did in this Knicks portion of the show, there's a lot
too
more
much. Who needs that?
We have a lot more from Dan over at Yahoo Sports. And I just recently wrote a post about the 7 New Year's resolutions for the NBA to get even better, including I just teased a little bit about that 58-game season and hopefully we get a shortened season so that, you know, we can breathe a little bit in the NBA schedule. We can talk more about these games that seem to happen at such an asteroid through space. Pace. How about that pace and space reference right there? Dan, thanks so much. Everyone, please be safe. Enjoy your weekend. I guess we're kind of at the weekend. We're halfway through.
It's Wednesday. So.
not even close. I want to give a proper send off here, Dan, because our production team during the holidays, post NBA Cup action, they are not slumping. You know, they're giving it their all and stepping up and beyond. Shout out to Ryan and Emmy behind the scenes for making this show a reality. A reminder that this show and all of our NBA podcasts are on our new YouTube channel at Yahoo NBA. Go check that out. Kevin O'Connor Show, The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe to that channel. Thanks, everyone, for listening and subscribe and rate, review. And we'll see you next week.